is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
It's hard and it's not perfect and it's messy, but it makes you better in the long run. And if you commit to it, you will improve as a coach more than anything. And obviously as a byproduct, your players will too.
Coach Chris Oliver has 23 years of university coaching experience. Chris was the head coach at the University of Windsor for 14 seasons, where he won over 300 games and compiled a 750 winning percentage. Oliver has also coached a Canadian team of professional players to the prestigious Jones Cup International Basketball Tournament Championship, winning gold in 2018. In addition, he has consulted for NBA, NCAA, high school, and club basketball organizations around the world. Coach Oliver is the founder and operator of Basketball Immersion and the Basketball Podcast with Chris Oliver. Basketball Immersion is a one-stop website dedicated to all aspects of playing and teaching the game of basketball. The Basketball Podcast features coaching conversations with basketball coaches from all levels of coaching. Chris is also the founder of COBA Basketball Camps and a camp director for Breakthrough Basketball. Prior to his time at Windsor, Chris served as the head coach at Queen's University for 3 seasons. He was also an assistant coach at McMaster University and the University of Victoria. Chris has been a clinician and a camp speaker throughout the world and is dedicated to sharing the game. After you finish listening to this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app. Those ratings help others in the basketball community to find our show. Make sure you subscribe to the Hoopheads podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google Play so you never miss an episode. Get ready to learn from one of the most innovative minds in the game of basketball, Coach Chris Oliver from Basketball Immersion.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome from Basketball Immersion, Coach Chris Oliver. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Mike and Jason. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we are absolutely excited to have you on. You've got some very unique and innovative things that you're doing there with Basketball Immersion, both in terms of your basketball decision training and your podcast. And just, I think there's a lot of things that if coaches are out there listening, that they'll be able to take away from tonight's episode based on some of the things that you're going to be able to share. I want to start out by asking you to go back a little bit in time and talk to us about when you first thought that basketball coaching might be something that you wanted to do in your future.
Well, and I haven't been asked this in, for a while, so it's a great question. And I was with a group of business people a few weeks ago, and one of the things that came up was the importance of an origin story in sharing your story, your passion, or selling something in the case of them. And it's fascinating because my origin story really isn't that interesting. So I had to make one up, and I know we're going to talk about our around the world trip. And that kind of was the origin story of Basketball Immersion. But in terms of me personally, in Canada, I grew up playing hockey, soccer, love those sports. And basketball was, it came to me late, and it came to me about the seventh grade, and I fell in love with it. And the reason I fell in love with it was because I didn't need anyone else. I just needed a basketball. And it just seemed so simple to me that if I wanted to get better at a sport like basketball, all I needed to do was practice. And I tried a lot of different sports. I was grateful. I had a great childhood. Parents exposed me to a lot of different things. But at the end of the day, I certainly fell in love with the sport where I felt like if a friend didn't want to play, if a parent didn't want to come out and play, or my brother, or whatever it was, I could just go play basketball. And then from there, what always intrigued me about sport from any sport I played was kind of the thinking part of the game. I knew pretty early, and maybe it's intuitive or maybe it's an understanding brought by so many different coaches or mentors, but that I wasn't a great athlete relative to some people, but that there was that perceptual side, which I now call perceptual. At the time, I had no idea. But right. That perceptual side of things that kind of, you know, that could help me kind of be better than I was. And, you know, that was pretty early that I kind of fell in love with that and coaching and education and learning and just becoming the best player I could be. And, you know, to make a long story short, I didn't play university basketball. I was a normal student for about a half semester. Then I went to a local YMCA and said, hey, do you need anyone to coach? And from there, you know, I coached as many teams as possible over the next whole bunch of years. And that's kind of how I moved into coaching and coaching basketball specifically.
What do you remember about those first experiences? I'm assuming you were coaching young kids there at the Y. So what do you remember about those first experiences, both in terms of just your level of enjoyment of it. And then two, maybe looking back and reflecting on what were some of the things that maybe you did that now you're like, I'm not sure that I was doing that 100% right. I was very enthusiastic, but maybe not, coaching at the same level of, thought that you are now today.
Well, I think even at that point, I mean, I was always a competitive person. I was always very a focused person. So I think sometimes that's off-putting. And I think a lot of my early experiences actually beyond the why, some of my first coaching experiences were with JV girls and varsity girls. And I think that was the best experience for me in terms of my growth as a coach, because I didn't have sisters. I had a brother only. So it was putting me in an environment where I immediately had to figure things out at a different level. And it wasn't just the level of the, age-appropriate coaching or age-appropriate things that I was teaching from a physical standpoint. It was also just the psychology of coaching, like a different species almost at that time for me.
Absolutely.
As I learned like the psychology of that. And it was absolutely brilliant for me to be able to be put in that situation. So I remember how poor I was at first at communicating with them. And really, really getting into that deep understanding of how to communicate and the importance of communication, really, in general. I mean, I think I was so technically, tactically oriented. And, at a young age, I really thought that the game was just a sort of, this X's and O's battle back and forth, which was so fun and motivating. But at the same time, clearly success has to do with we're coaching human beings. So I had to learn how to coach human beings. And I think that's what the part that came out from those really early years in coaching.
What were one or two things that you learned specifically in those early years that you still carry with you today in terms of that communication piece or that relationship with players piece? Because I think I agree with you in the standpoint of when I think about myself as a young coach, what was important to me was the X's and O's and the design of practice and getting a drill together. And it wasn't necessarily that communication and those relationships. So what did you learn in those early years by coaching those girls that you still carry with you today in your coaching?
The value of a one-on-one conversation. And I still say this all the time to coaches, and I truly believe this, is that whatever buzzword you want to use, culture, cohesion, whatever it is, those aren't formed with any singular event. Those are formed on a daily basis with all the mini conversations you have with players before practice, during practice, especially after practice, the aftercare that happens. And that's really, again, what I took away from those years. I was really bad at that. And I can still go back in some of the notes that I wrote back then in my early learning years. And there's a lot of notes that reference that, how do I connect with this person? How do I do a better job communicating what I want to do? And as a secondary thing, I'll give you a really specific example that talks about detail. And the importance of just making sure that I don't make assumptions with my teaching and I don't generalize. And this is something that's carried on throughout my life, to never generalize someone and say, okay, this is all people. Because, again, we're coaching individuals, we're coaching humans. So a real specific example was I had a player, her name was Casey, and I had a habit of shortening names. And I still find that I like very efficient communication. So I shorten things as much as possible, whether it's names or acronyms or whatever it is. And I called her Case. And in the second year of coaching her, I finally had a one-on-one conversation with her. And just said, hey, what can I do better to help you, be a better player, help you, develop better as a student, whatever that was. And she said, I don't like it when you call me Case. My name's Casey. And it just hit home right there again. And I still reflect. And I tell this story in all my coaching classes, just about, again, these assumptions sometimes that we make without ever asking the question. And the only way I would have found that out is if I had a mini conversation, because that communication would never have came out from Casey in a group setting. And you know that as coaches, how intimidated some people are to speak in a group setting. But in those one-on-one comfort conversations, it's a completely different deal. And just such an important lesson that, I hope has been a foundation of my success in coaching, whatever success I've had.
So I think there's two pieces to that I want to follow up on. And those one-on-one conversations, I know you mentioned that you do them informally. And I know that I've seen that you have sort of a format for doing 1-minute meetings with your players on a fairly regular basis, which are more, I don't want to say formal is maybe not the right way to say it, but just a planned short meeting, short little conversation to kind of get the temperature of the player, where they're at, what they're feeling, and that kind of thing. So can you talk about maybe those two aspects of, you know, the informal conversations that you have daily with players and kind of how you go about making those happen? And then maybe the formal, you know, the more formal 1 minute meetings that you have with players to check in and see where they're at so that you get a feel for what they're doing and what you can better provide them as their coach.
For sure. I mean, again, I don't think a player sitting in my office, I get what I need out of them most of the time. So what I mean by these informal conversations is they happen, you know, obviously Greg Popovich takes them for really expensive dinners and has these kind of
buys them wine. And you're probably not buying your players wine when you're a college coach. Yeah, probably not going to happen.
No, but you know, maybe I take them for a donut or something like that. But you know, like you have those type of moments where you can take them a little bit more formally and say, hey, let's get together for something. Or it could be just before practice or after practice where, I think like all coaches, I try to connect with every player before practice. I try to have some type of conversation with them. Mostly it's not to do with basketball. Mostly it's just, hey, you know, I knew they had an exam coming up, or I, their favorite team is, you know, Cleveland Cavaliers. So I say, hey, you know, did you see them play last night? Or some type of kind of really, you know, informal focus to start with. And then if I need to with that, I can bring them to something and say, listen, I was watching some game film. I'm going to send you some tonight. I just want you to see, understand that this is what I am sending it for. This is why I'm sending it. I might show them something, or it may lead to something a little bit more formal in terms of basketball. But that's what I mean by those really informal ones. And, you know, sometimes it's just a case of you have a message, and instead of communicating that message to the whole team, it's kind of like that old telephone game back in the day where, you know, pre-technology, kids probably don't even know what that is nowadays,
right,
but
exactly.
You know, you pass along the message, so to speak. And if you want to pass along the message, you got to start it with the right people. And then you probably got to communicate it to more than just one, so the message is clear. And sometimes that's the process too, is I just want to communicate a certain message, an understanding or different things like that. So in terms of what you talked about the 1 minute, I call it the 1 minute drill for feedback, but Russ Rose, who's, volleyball coach at Penn State, has stole it from him. And, you know, basically the goal is to do it, whether it's on a regular basis, weekly, biweekly. We were more biweekly, just because, again, I didn't like the formality of necessarily meeting all the time, but, it's just a way to be able to kind of talk about roles. Cause again, I think in all these conversations you probably had with coaches on the podcast, and I've had with coaches on a podcast, you know, inevitably a question comes up is like, how do you define roles? How do you accept roles? How do you get players to accept roles? And it's amazing, like at all levels, like you're talking to NBA coaches, NCAA coaches, high school coaches, it's all the same. It's just never a happy world on your team. It never is. I mean, we like to believe it is, and I think a lot [S2] Right. [S1] Of these teams are portrayed as that. But I guarantee you, even some players on that Virginia team that won an NCAA championship were unhappy at the end. You know, and they just won an NCAA championship. But they were unhappy because, again, they have a singular focus. And us as coaches, we have a bigger, broader focus. So these 1 minute drills for feedback, this is basically simple. So we would talk about what are they doing well, what they need to work on, and then where can they make the best contribution to the team in the next part or the next phase. So whether it's a 2 week phase, we could be talking about a month phase, but it was, what are they doing well? What do they need to work on? And then what do we feel together that they can do to make their best contribution to the team? And sometimes with that, I would seek assistant coaches feedback prior to the meetings. Sometimes I wouldn't, depending on that. And then if you're really brave as a coach, you can certainly seek, you know, players anonymous feedback in some way with the Google survey or something to get teammates feedback on players. But it just gave an opportunity for us to really communicate very specifically. And they're meant to be very short, where I just communicate for 1 minute to them.
And how receptive, or how did the players feel about those meetings? Do you feel like they felt that they were beneficial, that it gave them a direct voice to your ear? Whereas a lot of times I think players sometimes can feel like they're, hey, I'm in the dark, or hey, I don't feel comfortable approaching my head coach or even an assistant because, oh, I'm not sure if what I'm going to say is going to, how it's going to be received. So did you get good feedback just in terms of the player's ability then to communicate with you, that open line of communication?
Well, it's not perfect. There's no perfect method. Like, unless players are honest, then it's really hard no matter what method you go to. And again, players have a real hard time being honest with a coach because they feel a coach has control and power over them, which is true. Even if you don't act that way as a coach, you certainly do have control and power. And that's a real dangerous thing. And I think what these meetings did is, I don't know how you guys are evaluated, but I have an evaluation at the end of the year where my players get to give anonymous feedback through my athletic director. And then I get evaluated by my athletic director. So I have direct evaluation. Almost every year, there's evaluations from the players that says there needed to be more communication. It doesn't matter. It didn't matter how many times we met.
Right.
Like, and I would have these experiences. It's kind of like free throws, which we can talk about if you want. But we can practice free throws, shoot 1,000 a day, every day. And we've gone through years where we literally haven't shot a free throw ever in a practice. And I don't think there was any correlation with our percentage. Well, at least the studies I did for the 2 years we did. There was no direct correlation between us practicing it or not practicing it and the success.
All right, so let's talk about why is that? Let's jump to that. Why is that? I'm fascinated by this. Why?
Well, again, that gets us into that whole motor learning and skill acquisition. But I think so much of it relates to free throw practice. There's almost zero ways to replicate free throw shooting in a practice. And here's why. We've gone to a randomized method, and coaches can try this. But the randomized method of us shooting free throws in practice is now at a completely random moment. And sometimes I forget for a long time. Sometimes I remember. Sometimes it's a lot. I'll just say 2 free throws. And they go to the free throw, and we play FIBA, so they get 2 no matter what. There's no bonus, but you can do bonus, obviously, in that. And then we just track those free throws throughout a practice. And they are completely random moments. We could be in the middle of a great drill, and I would just call, okay, 2 free throws. And then we get right back into the drill after they do it. They shoot them. They go tell the manager tracks them. And then what I've found by doing that is that percentage more closely correlates with their game percentage. But it's not perfect. But it's better because those are randomized and random moments, as opposed to you've seen free throw charts. I've been to professional gyms and seen NBA teams have a free throw chart, and they have, you know, so-and-so shot 1,000 free throws and they made 90% of their free throws. Well, I guarantee all those free throws were somewhat blocked and on air, meaning there was clearly no other variable other than them being alone in a gym with a rebounder and shooting free throws. Well, we know that's not how the game or how free throw happens. So that's why I say that when we practiced a lot and when we haven't practiced it a lot, it hasn't necessarily impacted our free throws. What I find does impact free throws, and coaches should consider more, is spending way more time, and this circles back to these one-on-one conversations, with players on developing their free throw routine, their mental focus routine, and, you know, I don't know if you want me to keep going on free throws, but
no, keep going. Absolutely. What's your thoughts on visualization?
I'm 100% on board with any type of psychology. And here's where I was going to go with this, is that, like, free throws is the one time in the game, and it's a complete contradiction, but it's the one time in the game where you have the broadest focus as a player shooting the free throw. Like, when you're playing the game and you're playing 5-on-5 and going back and forth, as a player, you have a very narrow focus because you're not aware of your surrounding as much. And I think it's the same for a coach, right? Like, if you asked me after a game and said, hey, did you see, my wife would say, hey, did you see so-and-so in the stands? Or did you see when this happened, you know, in the stands or beside you or something? I'd be like, no, I didn't even know that was going on.
Question about that.
But
ask me all the time when I was playing, and, you know, people who haven't played at whatever high level. I mean, I played at a Division I school, but, you know, not at a major school. I played at Kent State. But people used to ask me all the time. They're like, wow, you were at this game and there was 7,000 people there. And, you know, didn't you notice the crowd and this? And I'm always like, no, you know, I mean, I didn't notice it at all. Because to your point, you're dialed in and your focus is so narrow on what you need to do on the floor that if I'm worried about what's going on in the stands, chances are I wouldn't have been on the court anyway if I was worried about what was going on the stands instead of what I was supposed to be doing out on the floor. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but wanted to share that.
It's a perfect segue, because that's exactly what we're talking about, is that that's you're in this really narrow focus. But when you go to the free throw line, it becomes a broad focus. Even though the game slows down and literally stops for you to shoot the free throw, now, because nothing else is going on, an athlete tends to become very aware of everything. And it's the one time that, you know, a player really has to learn how to narrow their focus. And we talk about this a lot, and sports psychologists talk about this too, is that there has to be this process for us as coaches to be able to educate our players when they don't need to be focused. And that's almost more important, because this is a big thing for me too, that going on these, and I don't mean to go on a pulpit here, but when coaches generalize things, they call, like, one of the words they'll say is, we got to be more focused. Well, what does that mean? Like, we got to work harder. What does that mean? Like, we need to be very specific with what that means when we say those words for players. And that's a question for coaches. When you say these things, do your players know what you mean by them? And when we say we need to be focused, our players need to understand when they don't need to be focused. Because I think they have this perception that they always have to be focused and they have to be dialed in. But, you know, I mean, there's times in games where you don't have to be focused, and they don't have to tell me they're not focused, but I've educated them about those moments where they can drop focus. And a free throw is that thing. It's like, okay, when you don't have the ball, just chill, relax. But as soon as you get that ball, there's that narrow your focus, focus in, visualization, maybe part of the routine. It may be, you know, some type of thought stopping. It may be something else in terms of a cue, but those things all happen. And, you know, that's really what I mean about those things. So being able to have these meetings and being able to kind of formalize some of these things. But again, what you know about players and what I know about players is, well, maybe some people don't, but players don't like meetings. Players don't like long video sessions. Players don't like long, you know, long things that monopolize their time.
Right.
So that's constantly a battle for me. And that's why I talk about these 1 minute meetings and these informal conversations.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to be able to keep the lines of communication open, but not become long-winded. I know that's one of the things that we've talked to a bunch of different coaches here on the show that have talked about how they've grown as coaches and evolved to the point where, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, or when they were first a young coach, they would stop practice, stop a drill, or, you know, go to the beginning of practice and give these 5-6 minute sermons about different things. And, you know, now they realize after having been in the business for a long time that 15 seconds after they started, everything else they said after that was completely lost on their players. And I think being able to coach in much shorter bursts and much more explicit terms, like you said, in terms of saying, hey, be more focused, or hey, work harder. You need to explain to a player, in this drill, here's what working harder looks like. This is the exact specific behavior that I'm looking for, as opposed to just this generality of, hey, work harder. Same way with, you know, I know we've heard it said about praise, that when you just continuously say to a player, good job, good job, good job, eventually that becomes meaningless. Whereas if you can point out a specific thing that the player's done well in a drill or on a particular technique or a particular decision they made, now you're reinforcing that behavior that you want to get more of. And I think that's kind of what we're talking about here, is making sure that we're on point and being effective and efficient with the way that we're coaching.
No question. And record yourself. Like, I say this to every coach, like, record yourself, listen to yourself. Like, it's amazing when you do that process of recording yourself and listening to yourself in practice and some of the things you say. And again, there's still so many things that I'm working on about what I say in practice, but being more aware of what I'm saying and how I'm saying it is just so important. And I'll give you another one that's just real quick is game speed. There's another thing that just, again, I know coaches, oh, well, you're just, you know, you're just getting into semantics. And I'm like, I get that. Okay, I'm getting into semantics. But what we mean generally when we say game speed to a player is we want them to play hard, right? Oh, we got to go game speed in this drill. Well, that means we want them to go really fast and go hard. But really, you know, you played at a high level. Game speed is the opposite of playing hard all the time. Game speed is change of pace, short bursts, right? It's not this constant, we just go 110%, 100%. And I say it to players all the time that basketball is played best at 80 to 90%.
Chris, that's absolutely true. I'll tell you when I learned that for the first time is I was probably, I don't know, maybe 13 or 14 years old. And this was back when the Cavs played at the old Richfield Coliseum. And I had a friend whose family had season tickets on the floor. And I went and got an opportunity to watch an NBA game from a floor seat. And you watch an NBA game from that close up, as opposed to, you know, being in the nosebleeds or even watching it on TV. And you're struck by the fact that for 90% of the time that those players are on the floor, they're moving very little or very, very slowly. And then to your point, it's these quick bursts of speed and quickness and attacks or closeouts or whatever it is. And I just remember being amazed at like watching and saying, most of the time, these guys are just standing still or they're barely moving. They're jogging, they're walking. And then it's just, boom, this change of pace. And the very best players are the ones who can use deception and change of speed to be able to get where they want to go on the floor or to be able to stop somebody who they're trying to guard. And I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, what a great moment that you learned it so young. Honestly, I mean, I think we send such a false message to players about this. And again, I know from the camps I work and just at all these different places how I have to get players to slow down. And And it's also, isn't that funny that that's the thing that the NBA gets knocked for? Oh, they don't play
right.
hard.
Yeah.
Well, it's the opposite.
So when I heard you say that, when I heard you say the 90% thing, I looked at Mike and I said, Russell Westbrook. I just wish that he would learn. If he just learned to slow down a little bit, I feel like he would excel so much more in the NBA than he does now. And I mean, he's a stat machine. I get it. But I still think that if he did exactly what you said and just slowed himself down, he'd be so much better player.
Well, and again, like I talk about ball screen. I mean, we run a lot of ball screen, but ball screen, playing in the post, playing at the high post. Like there's certain points on offense, and offense is easier for people to understand. That'd be sacrilege for me to say you have to slow down on defense, but it's true too. Right. But, on offense, the game slows down in those moments, especially in ball screen. Like if you watch really good players use a ball screen, and by and large, that's NBA players, NCAA players, there's very few that really slow down in a ball screen to make a decision. And that's a big difference. And if you can get players to slow down in a ball screen rather than rush it, because again, that's a one time that you have a singular focus. You have to make a decision off the ball screen rather than, again, I know a lot of ball screen action is just used to move the ball, but I'm talking when there's actually an attacking ball screen situation and it's like, slow the game down. The three other players are reading what you're doing off the ball. The one player on the ball is going to make a decision relative to how the two defenders covering the ball and covering the screen are covering. And then you just make the decision. And that doesn't have to happen fast. And it's such a hard thing, but there's an example of that's a game speed. The game slows down in those moments. So if we're constantly saying game speed is playing hard, playing fast, then we're giving a false impression of what that really is.
Yeah, I agree. I think you go watch a youth game and you get an idea of everybody is running 90 million miles an hour all the time. And there's no idea of when it's appropriate to slow down. It's kind of like the exact opposite. And you would expect it to be, obviously. But I think that as you see players mature up through the levels, you see them start to understand to some degree, you see them start to understand the idea of I can still be playing hard, but I don't have to be going 100 miles an hour. I could be running at 33 RPM instead of 100 RPM and still being just as effective because I'm able to change speeds and change pace and slow down at moments when it's appropriate and attack when it's appropriate. And I think that, like I said, when you watch the NBA game up close and you watch the best players in the world, you're constantly amazed by the fact that it's really those short bursts. It's not that they're running 100 miles an hour the whole entire possession or the whole entire quarter. It's that they know when they need to move quickly and when they don't. And that's something that is hard sometimes to teach. And it's really hard to get young players to understand that for sure.
It is, but it is a teachable skill. Like that's a teachable skill. But you're right. I mean, it's hard. I mean, I think everything in teaching in general, like education, forget about just basketball. Everything's hard. It's right. hard. It's hard to right. teach.
So how do you teach that? What are some things that you do to try to get your players to understand the idea of playing with a change of pace and not just having to be running at full cylinder all the time?
Well, again, philosophically, for those that don't know, we practice with a games approach to coaching, which means essentially our players, by and large, are always playing basketball in practice, meaning we don't do any drills without defense. We do almost everything competitive, offense versus defense. And because we do that, they're almost always within a game situation or a game scenario. And sometimes that might be a starting point where it might be, okay, we're going to start on a wing ball screen here, 4-on-4. But then after that, we're going to play three trips of the floor live and we'll see what happens. And not just roll the balls, we're playing within our concepts, we're playing within our structure, whatever that may be. But that's basically it. So within that, how do we get them to slow down is I stop and start. And you talked about that a little bit earlier, is that number one, coaches need to coach within the context of the game. And I think, again, drills have become this thing to teach and coach, and scrimmages has been this time to let them play. It would be the opposite in my world. If I was doing a drill, essentially for them to get mass reps with very little other than them focused on mass reps. Whereas when they're playing, that's when I'm stopping it, because I'm stopping it in those moments where I can get them to understand is, listen, look, you rush this off. And usually it's related to a decision, right? You rush this decision off the ball screen. You didn't need to. Take extra time, set your player up, jab them a little bit more, back them in a little bit more. Let the screen get a little bit deeper. Let the screen readjust. There's all these communication moments within the context of the game that hopefully transfers more directly to the game because it's communicated within that context. So that's what I mean. I mean, I say it to all young coaches is that you're going to be too soft when you start coaching. And I don't mean hard or soft versus, you know, in terms of yelling or in terms of, you know, whatever that Tom Izzo debate was. You know, I'm not talking about that. What I'm talking about, will you stop and teach when it's necessary to stop and teach? And I think coaches have this fear about doing this. And I am the absolute opposite. I say, if anything, stop and teach more. And the games are the time where you can let them play. But in practice, they need to be stopped and taught. And as we talked about already, short bursts of information, quick communication, sometimes we would call it like where we want to go back and refresh it, redo it, put them back in the situation, whatever it may be. But we want them to get the context of what we're trying to talk about and to understand decisions. You've got to do it within the context.
Okay, so here's a question for you. When I was a young coach, so this was my very first year coaching, and I had just gotten done with my playing career, and I was hired as a junior varsity coach at a high school near where I grew up. And I walked into practice that first day, and at some point, you know, we started doing our scrimmaging. And I remember watching for like 5 minutes and just being overwhelmed by the number of things that I wanted to stop and try to fix. And so my question for you is, if we're talking to young coaches here, or even experienced coaches, how do you strike a balance, you personally, how do you strike a balance between stopping practice to instruct, to teach, like you just described, and making sure that you can get through and play for more than 5 or 10 seconds at a time through a drill? How do you go about understanding or thinking about what needs to be stopped and talked about and what you can let go in that particular moment? Is there something that, like, okay, in this drill, we're focusing on ball screen reads, and if I see a poor ball screen read, we're going to stop it and we're going to talk about it? Or are you looking for more general things? Just talk about what your process is for when you stop a drill versus when you don't.
Yeah, it's a great question. So it's essentially my communication cues in practice are, and again, keep in mind, like for a whole hour and a half or hour 45, whatever we're practicing, we're offense versus defense. And we've gone through years where it's essentially all 5-on-5, that we don't do any other fluff. We don't do any other stuff. We practice whatever we're doing 4-on-4, 5-on-5 by and large. So the communication cues are within that foul. Foul to my players means not a referee. It means there's a teaching moment. Usually it's foul, it's recreate, or I remind them. So recreate would be, we go recreate the scenario. Remind is just within that moment, foul, remind them, hey, listen, you didn't set up the ball screen, right? And then either we continue from there or we recreate and we go show it And then obviously sometimes there's a demo with that, or usually there's a question. And instead of me telling it's often foul, let's recreate. Hey, Mike, what was your thought process here in coming off the ball screen? What did you see? And then sometimes it takes a little longer. But the whole point of all this that we do is for retention and transfer. And retention and transfer means everything in coaching. If I teach something, I'm not teaching a coaching clinic. I'm not trying to impress my administrators. I am trying to get my players to be able to retain the information. And then most importantly, to be able to use that information in a game. And that's really hard. So to come back to what you asked, coaches, again, there's no moment where I wouldn't stop it to correct something that I feel my players need to be held accountable to. So what does that all come back to? It comes back to an agreement. I have to have an agreement with my players. There's only a few reminders now. I was very fortunate early on when I did this there with, say, a new group, there were a lot more reminders. But as we built this and as we built this structure over my 14 years at the University of Windsor, that these moments became less and less because my players bought in and said, hey, listen, we can do three-man weave. We can do, you know, closeout drills. We can do all this stuff, or we can play basketball in practice and learn by doing it. But the trade-off by learn by doing is we have to stop it. We have to stop it to coach, and players buy in. Now, naturally, as the season evolves, there's less and less stoppages. As we move into the competitive phase where we play more games, whether that's conference, wherever it is, there's just less and less stopping because, you know, we're better. Or to a certain extent, well, we're not going to change that behavior that much right now anyways, so we can let that go. But early on in the season, there's a lot of stop. There's a lot of hold. There's a lot of all that. And I think that's honestly what's resonated a lot with the basketball immersion members is they've got to see us practice and they've got to see that methodology in place. So I think it gives some confidence to those people that believe in this game's approach to say, hey, listen, I have to stop to teach. And that's how we do it.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
One of the things that I've learned over the course of time, and I think part of seeing what you do got me to think about it. I know one of the blog posts you had at one point was why you hate the three-man weave. I can't remember the exact title of it, but every time now I see the three-man weave, I honestly think of you and basketball immersion because I look at it and I say, yeah, I wonder why that coach is doing that. And I think about, again, my time as a player and how much time I spent, you know, even at the college level, running a three-man weave or a five-man weave. And, you know, your question, I think, in your blog was, you know, well, why are you doing that? What is the purpose of doing the three-man weave? And you could, I guess, come up with a purpose, but most of the time there really is no purpose. It's just, well, everybody always does the three-man weave, so we should do it too. And so I think that it's just an interesting way of, for me, that I've evolved as a coach to try to put my players in more game-like situations and try to make the learning like the game, because I know we can get into sort of the motor learning theories and sort of the science behind it, but you mentioned about, you know, being able to learn and to retain and then to be able to demonstrate those skills. And certainly if you're just, you know, doing a crossover dribble on a cone and then shooting a right-handed layup, there's not too often in a game that the cone's going to be out there guarding you. There's going to be a human being that's going to adjust and do things, and you got to be able to react to that. And so I think it's just it's interesting the way that I grew up in the game as a player, and then early on in my coaching career, thinking about what good coaching looks like. And, you know, a lot of times there was a perception that the great coaches are the ones who have, you know, the giant three-ring binder full of drills, and the coaches who didn't know what they were doing were the guys who just rolled the balls out and let people scrimmage. And obviously what you're describing is sort of in, I don't want to say necessarily an in between, but it's the scrimmaging, but with the coaching piece of it that is tied into what you're seeing out there on the floor versus the drill work that sometimes is perceived as, oh, look, that guy knows what he's doing. He has all these drills versus, you know, learning can be messy. And when you're trying to teach it 5-on-5, it doesn't look as pretty as it does when you have four lines of kids, you know, crossing over at a cone and going and taking a shot. So I've certainly come around and become a much better coach as a result of kind of taking this games-based approach, because I believe in the science behind it. And I believe that it does help, you know, help to transfer, you know, that learning into what the players are actually going to face when they play a game.
Well, again, amazing. Congratulations. It involves self-reflection. It involves some looking at some historical and cultural norms and saying, hey, does this make sense? And again, everything changes. Everything evolves. I mean, you know, the game's different from the way it's played, but what hasn't evolved much is how we teach. And I'm sure there's a lot of classrooms in the world that haven't evolved in terms of how we teach. So, and that's kind of, well, it's scary to be honest. So I hope coaches, if nothing else, come away from this and say, hey, listen, just think about what you do. Cause I've had professional, like I've been blessed to be able to present in front of some really high level coaches that have come to me, you know, weeks later, a year later, and I've been able to ask them and say, what did you take away? And they said, we removed all the fluff, just all the fluff, all the stuff that you already alluded to that doesn't happen in the game. And here's something, here's a way if coaches wanted to frame it a little bit and say, okay, so if a coach tells the player exactly where to cut or what shot to shoot, it's not game-like. The game involves decision-making. So that does not mean that the drill that you choose is inherently bad. What more it means is it's just not game-like. So to the point of the three-man weave, this is not an attack on three-man weave. More the point is, well, what if you added a defender to three-man weave? Then suddenly there's decisions happening. Then suddenly it's more game-like. If you just added one defender to it, then it's better than if it's 3-on-0. Because 3-on-0 becomes mindless. I mean, think about you as a player. Even if you just say, well, we make it competitive because they have to get a score, they have to get a time. Well, you know what? You're smart as a player. You just memorize exactly how hard you got to go, the pace you got to go to get that done. And there's never any real challenge once you figure it out, right? And if
I totally agree. Yeah. Totally agree.
You know, and if anything, you drop passes and coaches get frustrated at players. Oh, you're not concentrating. You're dropping passes. Well, why are you not concentrating? Because you're not challenged.
Right, because it's a mindless drill.
Yeah, it's mindless. You're not challenged. There's no thinking. Of course you're not going to have focus. And that's the other part of it is that just drives me crazy that we hold players accountable to focusing in drills that aren't. So the question maybe I come back to you with is, you know, it's great that the science is all behind it, but just ask your players what they enjoy. Like, and I know it's not just about your players' enjoyment, because an inherent part of all practice is not enjoyable. But come on. Let's ask how our players enjoy practicing. And I got to think they enjoy playing basketball instead of just, you know, again, doing on-air drills all the time.
You would hope so.
You think?
You would hope so. All right, I want to jump back to something else you said that is another way that I think that coaching has definitely evolved from even 10 or 15 years ago. And you mentioned how when you do stop play, you tend to, rather than tell the players what you saw or what they should have done, instead you ask them a question. Can you explain why that's so important to the players learning as opposed to the coach just telling them what they saw or what they thought they should have done?
So it comes back to what we talked about, which is retention. right? And think about your student. You have a class, you have a test coming up. The class, you're able to memorize everything and regurgitate it, throw it up onto the paper. And then what happens 2 weeks later? Do you remember any of that information?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. So that's memorizing. That's essentially what we're doing in these drill scenarios, is we're getting players to memorize things. We're memorizing patterns, memorizing drills, memorizing pace, you know, different shots that you're telling me to shoot. And what we know about that is that players have a harder time retaining that. So the opposite is those classes or those situations where players have to constantly think. And I call it heightened mental effort. So when I ask you a question, I am engaging your mind in thinking. Now, there's an art to it too. And believe me, it's not easy, and I'm not the greatest at it, because I'm just like everyone. Sometimes as coaches, we ask questions and we're impatient and we hate silence. So we don't wait for the answer and we don't wait for thinking. And having a delay in the process is really important. Hey, you know, Mike, what were you thinking on this down screen? And then we need silence. And it's really hard, right? Like, silence is really the enemy of a coach.
It truly is. You're 100% right. I've been there many times where you ask that question and you get a bunch of blank stares and you're immediately ready to jump back in. I do it as a teacher all the time too. And something that you have to be mindful of as the person who's up in front of the class or up in front of the team, for sure.
Well, and I'll tell you a little trick. Well, I'm sure you do this as a teacher, but the best teacher I ever had was the one I feared the most. And I feared them in the sense that they never asked for participation. They never asked a question and let someone put up their hand. They asked a question and they just pointed and asked, Chris, what's the answer?
Right.
And I was scared every day in that class. But you know what I was every day in that class? More prepared than I've ever been.
You were engaged, absolutely.
I was engaged every moment of that class. I was scared. I was engaged. And again, I'm not sure fear is the right emotion. That's maybe not the right way, but I was prepared, right? I was going to say, if she's going to call on me, I'm going to have an answer. And that, and again, not everyone's wired that way, maybe, but for me, that was the best environment. And I still remember so much of that information from that class. And that's really how I try and approach questions. And it's the other trick I'll tell people is make sure that you again, this is communication in advance, but it's also reminders that players, teammates don't save them. Because it's like, I go, hey, Mike, what's the answer? And you know what? They're great teammates. And I'll say that, hey, listen, you're a great teammate. But you know what? That doesn't help Mike think.
Right. That doesn't help Mike get better. Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
Like, Jason, you're a really good guy helping Mike. But you know, it doesn't help him. So, and it's tricky, right? Because we don't like silence. And you know what? Players don't like silence. But again, you have to explain why you're doing it. Why are we doing this? To heighten their thinking, right? We're trying to help them retain the information.
For sure. And I think that there's another key word that you just mentioned, which is the why. I think a lot of times, if I think back to my early years in coaching or certainly my playing days, there was a lot of things that were done that in my head, I was asking the question, why? And the why was never really presented to me. And it, I think, confused me as a player. And so now, as I've, again, evolved and tried to grow as a coach, you want to try to give players why, and you want to put them in situations that, again, relate to what they're going to see in the game. And when we do have something where we're working on, you know, a particular movement, or we're working out of a, you know, again, a ball screen, or we're working on a start of an offense or whatever it might be, and then we see that in a game, you know, I think it's important to point out, you know, I'll turn around to the bench and say, hey, do you remember when we worked on this, or when we talked about that? There's the situation where it just occurred. And I think we can bring it home for players like that, where they see that the things that they're practicing during your practice time happen in a game. It helps them to see that light bulb, you know, have that light bulb come on that, oh, we're not just doing something randomly because coach thinks it's a great idea, or it's fun, or it's not fun. It's something that actually translates to the game that can help us perform better when we're out there on the floor.
That's awesome. And I want to add two things to that, because you already said earlier in the podcast, you said talking about coaches saying good job. So let's bring that point home about why. So the why, So good job. When I say good job, that's non-specific. It's positive, but it's non-specific feedback. So we could label it as positive, non-specific feedback. When I say, okay, good job on the down screen, then that's positive, specific feedback. But there's still a problem there. At least they know what they did a good job on. So that's better than good job. But here's what you're saying, which is the why, and it's actually called value content. So we would go, good job on the down screen because you got to the shoulder of the screener. Like, you gave them a why was it a good job. And adding that value content to it just makes communication so much better because they know exactly what they did a good or a bad job on. And it's just as important on bad job stuff too. So, and then the other part you said is connecting. I'm a huge, and it's hard. It's really hard. And I'm not great at it, but we really tried this year. And in fact, in a game, I moved my seat to the middle of the bench. So I had players on both sides of me and I sat in the middle, assistant on each side. I had two assistants at the other end and some other players, support staff at the far end, but the players were basically connected with me. And what we tried to do is we tried to constantly communicate to our players exactly what you just were referring to. That's what we worked on. Like, if something worked, our motto basically was, that's what we worked on. That's what we worked on. Someone did attack the basket. We were working hard with them over the year on the back pivot. They did it. It worked. Even if they didn't make the shot, it doesn't matter if they made the shot or not. It was the right decision, and we try and focus on the decision over the outcome.
Right.
But that's what we worked on, and connecting those things. So the why and connecting that actually works, that's huge. And if you just spend all your time on that as a coach, it doesn't matter what you coach. It's going to be better. It's going to get better.
Yeah, and I think you have to be – this is one of the things that I find for myself, and one of the areas where I struggle is – I'll get, I don't know if excited is the right word, but I'll get on a kick where one of these things that we've been talking about, oh, I gotta make sure I ask more questions, and I'll be focused on that for, you know, a week of practice or a couple practices. And then next time I'll be like, oh, I gotta be more specific with my praise. And what I find is that I have to be very, very mindful heading into a practice setting or a game setting of some of the things that I want to make sure that I'm doing as a coach. And I find if I'm not mindful of those things, I guess maybe I haven't built a strong enough habit that it happens automatically. I haven't created that automaticity. Instead, it's something that I have to be very mindful of. And I think sometimes as coaches, we get caught up, we get excited about something and we do it for a week or two and then it fades away. And I think if I had any advice, kind of just generally putting all the things that we've been talking about into one bucket, it's that whatever you're going to do in terms of the things that we've been talking about, try to make sure that you're mindful of continuing them, not just for a day or a week or 2 weeks, but really commit to making those things a habit. And that's something that I need to work on for sure.
It's great. It's great advice. Cause again, it's okay. Like, for a coach, it's okay to not be perfect. Like, we're not. So you have to become conscious of something before it becomes unconscious. So exactly what you're saying, go in each week or each practice, whatever it is, with a conscious focus of something to do better. To not, it could be, again, forget about all this. It could be just not saying okay,
right,
or right? It could be something really simple like that and just being really conscious of it. That's how you change a behavior. That's the same thing we want for our players. We want them to become conscious of something so it becomes unconscious. And it's so, so important. And just to circle back, we talked about the games approach. And then how the challenges of doing that kind of is how we were talking. And it's like, it's absolutely true. It is really hard to coach the way that I coach, or even in saying, if you're not a full games approach coach, to coach a 4-on-4 drill. It's much harder to coach that than it is an isolated drill. There's no question, right? A controlled drill, a scripted drill. There's no easy way to say it. It's much harder. But
there's,
you know what?
There's a lot more things to look at in a set drill. There's one or two things you might be focused on, and you could just dial in on those things. Versus, we all know, it's like I said, when I spent that first 5 minutes of my coaching career looking at it, going, "There's 500 things I want to fix here in this first 5 minutes. How am I ever going to be able to fix all of them?"
Well, you can't. But you know what? It makes you a better coach. I am a better coach because for the last 20 years, I've been coaching this way. And I get asked by young coaches all the time, which I'm sure you guys do with the podcast and all that stuff. You get reached out to, how do you become a better game coach? I'm like, coach more games. Like, right. How do you become better at painting? You paint
experience.
More.
It's all about yes. experience.
And experience isn't age. It's not chronological. It's literally, again, how many experiences. So when I started coaching and I said, I'm going all in coaching after that first kind of 3 months at the YMCA, for the essentially the next, I think it was about eight to nine years until I got a head coaching job at 28 at a college, I coached as many teams as possible. I would coach six teams in a season. I just wanted as many experiences as possible. Because again, how do you get better? You got to do it. So the other part is about a games approach is you're coaching the game in practice. So you become a better game coach because you're coaching the game in practice. Right? You become aware of looking at offense, defense, and not just one thing. But again, it's hard. Don't get me wrong. It's hard and it's not perfect and it's messy, but it makes you better in the long run. And if you commit to it, you will improve as a coach more than anything. And obviously as a byproduct, your players will too.
Yeah, no question about that. All right, let's jump into basketball decision training, Chris, and talk a little bit about, first of all, how you came up with it, what it is, and how coaches out there can incorporate it into either what they do as individual skills trainers or into their team coaching.
Well, again, basketball decision training, it has a lot of different, you know, directions to go. If you think about, let's say, basketball decision training shooting, that initially was developed as a bridge between practicing on air and practicing live. And essentially what it is, was it a way to simulate decision making. Because at the end of the day, what happens first, no matter what we do in basketball, what happens first is the decision. The execution of that decision is the skill, right? So initially, like, we always talk about basketball in terms of building skill, then adding it to the game. And what I'm talking about is add decisions and then figure out the skills that go best with that. And it's abstract, and I get that, and I don't mean for it to be, but that's essentially what basketball decision training is. It's a focus on the decision first. And does it matter what the skill is as long as you make the right decision? Like, do I care how you, what type of layup you choose, where you shoot the layup from, etc., as long as you made the right decision? Like, yeah, okay, the skill matters, don't get me wrong, but what's really, I believe, is harder is that decision, right? And if we spend more time, especially youth level on up, with players on decision making, then we'd have better players. But we're obsessed with skill. We're obsessed, okay, you got to be the most skilled player. Well, ball mastery, comfort with the ball, I agree with all that. That's really important, because then you can execute the decision. And it's, I think some people get wrapped up in the chicken and the egg. They're you can't separate them. But I just don't think we spend enough time on the decision. So basketball decision training is basically this whole singular focus on that. And where does it come from? It comes from motor learning. It comes from skill acquisition, all research-based stuff. Goes back generations. I never came up with it. This is not new information. It just seems new to some people because you've been taught the way you've been taught, or you've been coached the way you've been coached. But some of the influential people, there's a coach in Italy, Massimo Antonelli, that teaches everything to music. He was extremely influential in a lot of this stuff. And then Joan Vickers is a sport researcher that actually coined the phrase decision training. And then from that research, I came up with kind of the concept of how to apply it within basketball. And, you know, from there, it's evolved in a lot of different directions, but essentially it's just with a focus on decision making.
So can you describe for people who maybe are completely unfamiliar with it, what it looks like on the ground? Just, and I know there's a lot of different ways that you could approach it, but just maybe, you know, if we think about, okay, just one thing, one concrete example of, here's a way that I can work with a player on improving their decisions. Just give people just a very, very basic framework. And then also maybe share, you know, where they can go on your website to be able to get the information and learn more about what you're doing.
Let's start with that. If they just go basketball decision training, if they type that in, basketball immersion, basketball decision training, they'll find some blogs and different things like that to be able to explore it more. And the basic concept that I share, and I'll use that here, is shooting. Shooting is the easiest one to understand. So basically, I tell you, I say, Mike, go shoot 10 shots from the elbow, and you shoot 10 repetitive shots over and over again. That's called block practice. That's repeating the same thing over and over again. Clearly, in that example, there's very little thinking. There's very little mental effort, because essentially after the first few reps, you've memorized exactly what to do. Because you're assuming, again, you have a basic skill level, you understand, you know, the distance, right. The arc, all that other stuff. So the opposite of that is random practice, which is now, instead of you shooting the same shot over and over again, I could have you move, I could have you turn, I could have you, again, incorporate, maybe it's a dribble into a shot, you know, there's different ways, so many different ways to make it more random or variable. So those are great. Random's better than blocked. After initial learning, because it's more game-like, it leads to more retention and transfer. But here's the problem. There's still no decisions there. So the easiest way to understand basketball decision training is, now I'm on the baseline or I'm on the side somewhere if there's another passer, and I pass it to the player shooting, and I give them some type of cue where they have to first have perception. They perceive my cue. And a cue would be, my arms out in front of me means pass the ball back to me. My hands are down means shoot the ball. So the player who's shooting first has to perceive whether my hands are out, my hands are down as the passer. And they make the decision based on that perception. And then, of course, they execute either a pass or a shot. And if you think about that, what we do know, that's not peer decision making, because peer decision making is really just offense versus defense, and it's completely random because we don't know what the defense is going to do. But in this example, we're somewhat simulating that, and that's why I call it a bridge, in the sense that at least that player has to think before they apply a skill, instead of doing that blocked shoot, or blocked pass. So that's the and I hope that was basic enough to understand.
No, that was totally basic.
Simple version.
Yeah, no, that's totally basic enough. I think it gives people an idea of what you mean and what you're trying to accomplish, which is to put a decision in front of the skill. And when you put a decision in front of the skill, you're making it more like what you would experience in a game where, you know, the ball's passed to me and I have to make a decision. First of all, am I open to shoot the ball? What should I pass it? Is there somebody else who has a better shot? Should I dribble? Should I drive? We all know there's millions of decisions that are made every single time you play. And so here you're boiling it down to making, in that very simple example, you're making one decision. You're looking for that cue. Then you're deciding, do I pass or do I shoot? But even just that little bit of thinking adds an element that most players never practice when they shoot. I mean, I would bet 99% of basketball players have never experienced the idea of, am I going to pass when I catch the ball, or am I going to shoot when I catch the ball? And I think about the time that I spent as a player, and I think about the time that I've spent as a coach doing shooting drills. And again, I've almost never, until I came across what you were doing, I never incorporated a decision into my shooting practices, especially as a player. I mean, I think about the workouts that I would do, and it was completely blocked. I'm going to make 15 one dribble jump shots. I'm going to make 6 layups after I dribble left and cross over back to the right and then go finish. And so I think by adding in that decision piece, you've made things more game-like. And obviously there's a lot more complexity to the whole thing, and you have a ton of information on your website. So anybody who's out there listening, I would highly recommend getting to Basketball Immersion and checking that out. And Chris has a lot of free resources on there, and he also has a member section. So I think that there's a lot of good stuff that you can find if you're a coach at any level and with any level of experience. All right, let's move to your trip around the world and talk about what you experienced during that year where you traveled around and visited with coaches and saw practices in countries all over the world, and the impact that had on you, and then how that led into what you're doing today.
For sure. Let's talk about that. If I can I add one thing to what you just said?
Absolutely.
By the way, thanks for talking about basketball immersion. And I'm glad it's had an impact. I'm glad it's at least had people thinking. And that's the whole point, to stimulate people's thinking. But think about it this way, because coaches know this analogy. And as a former player, you can reflect back on that and say, hey, listen, when you lift weights, if you lift the same weight over and over again for a whole year, Mike, Jason, what happens? Like, do you get stronger?
No, nothing.
You stay the same, or in some cases, you might get worse. So that's really the analogy that I think is simplest for coaches to understand, is regardless of whether it's adding decision-making or adding something, to any drill you do, you have to load it. You have to add something to challenge them in different ways. Because I think, again, there's this false impression that perfect practice is learning. You know what perfect practice is? They've already learned it. So like sometimes we pat ourselves on the back and we leap, oh, that was such an awesome practice. Like, we didn't make any mistakes.
Right. Everybody was perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's not learning. That means they can already do it. And that's something that I come back to all the time too. If they're not making mistakes, it's not somewhat messy, or they're not feeling challenged in some way, then they're not learning.
If you're a basketball coach in the greater Cleveland area and you have a passion for teaching the game and might be interested in joining the Head Start Basketball Camp coaching staff this summer, please reach out to us via email at headstartbasketball@usa.net.
This circles back perfectly to around the world. So we talked earlier about an origin story, and it really wasn't that intent at the time. It's just the way these business people framed it now that I look back at the trip around the world and I say, oh, that's kind of my origin story. But I had made a decision in 2014. I had some fears about it. I didn't want to share, you know, kind of what we do. I wasn't sure people would be interested. So I didn't start Basketball Immersion until 2014, even though the idea was with me to just authentically share what we do. But it coincided perfectly with me and my family. My daughters were 2 and 4 at the time, and my wife, us going around the world. And we ran, really selfishly, we went around the world. One, because we love travel and we wanted to expose our daughters to different things in the world, even though they wouldn't remember that much. It still helps shape them so much. We know that. But it was really selfish. So I was afforded to take a sabbatical by my university because I was in the professors union, which is really unique. I actually had to take 3 months, basically unpaid or vacation, but I had 4 months paid as a leave. And then selfishly, I could spend this much time with my daughters at such a valuable age, right? 2 and 4. I could just be their dad and be immersed in their life and be with them every day. And that's why I selfishly did it. From a other perspective, I said, well, you know what? I'm going to all these places. I'm going to go watch practices wherever I can. And it was amazing. I went to over 50 practices around the world. And the origin story is basically that I think I left those practices, or I went on the trip kind of expecting to see, oh, well, a lot of coaches do this already. And then what I came back with is, I can't believe a lot of this isn't common knowledge. And that's really the origin story of how I think I got more confidence to be able to share more of what I do, to say, listen, I think there's a demand for this because it's not being done as much as I thought it was. So that's really it.
That's very cool. Okay, a couple questions. One, let's start with a basketball related question. Then I want to ask you a non basketball related question. So, basketball related question: what was one thing that you took away from a coach, a practice? What's one thing that jumps out at you when you think about that trip that you're like, "Wow, this was something that I had never seen, never thought of." Something that you said, I immediately have to incorporate this into what I'm doing. Was there anything that stands out in that way?
Yes, lots. But let's give you like one that just always jumps to my mind, which is crazy because I got to spend some time with NBA teams. I saw Real Madrid, Barcelona, like big time pro teams over in Europe. A lot of NCAA practices before we went, as we drove down to California and stuff. So a lot of high level stuff. I want to reflect back on an under 10 practice in Portugal, not known as a basketball country, by the way. And it was FC Porto, their youth program, under 10. And FC Porto is pretty big pretty big soccer, you know, they're in Champions League and stuff this year. So I got to watch soccer practice too, but, or their youth academy, but I watched this basketball practice and I'm watching these under 10 players driving it and throwing one hand passes all over the floor. And to me, it just was one of these themes. And that was my first stop in Europe, in Portugal. And then I went to Spain and then went to Italy. And it's kind of what I hoped to see. And it was just such a positive impression on me to say, okay, good. There are some people that think this way too, that we're restricting kids, we're controlling kids. Let's give them some freedom. Let's teach some things that actually happen in the game, which, again, if you're watching the game nowadays, the best players in the world all throw one-handed passes.
Steph Curry did one the other night, right?
I just posted on Twitter. I posted on Twitter tonight and said, I'm teaching this to my daughter. Basically, am I crazy? And happily, most people maybe just didn't want to tell me I'm crazy, but
right.
There's a lot of support. So I know exactly the one you're saying, Jason. It was an incredible pass to the weak side. And I'm watching these under 10 kids do it. And they weren't good at it. You know, it wasn't like I left there going, oh my gosh, these kids are phenomenal at it.
Right, right.
But they got coached to do it because anytime a player touched it with their other hand, there was correction. And then when they played, they were encouraged. And I asked the coach later. I didn't know within the context of how they're playing, but essentially that was a constraint. They had to pass with one hand. And they applied it. They didn't just do it. They applied it. And it was just phenomenally impressionable on me.
Yeah, that's cool. So here's what I take away from that story. And I think regardless of the skill that you might have been focusing on, it could have been a totally different skill. One of the things that I think is critically important, especially with youth players, is the fact that when you're teaching them a skill that is uncomfortable, that's beyond their current capability, you then have to praise the effort of them trying that skill in a game as opposed to praising the result. And I always go back to one of the things that I'm probably the most proud of in my coaching career is actually my son's now in seventh grade. And we had his team first came together as third graders. One of the things that I made a commitment to with myself and one or two of the other guys who were helping me coach at the time was, we want to teach all these kids to be able to shoot left-handed layups, and we want them to be able to do it correctly. And we want to make sure that when they're on the left side of the floor, that they can shoot the ball with their left hand. And so I told all the coaches that were involved with our team that whenever a kid shoots the ball with their left hand, I don't care if the ball goes flying out of bounds. I don't care if it goes up 6 inches above their hand and comes down and hits them in the nose, that we were going to praise those left-handed layups. And we stuck with it all year. I mean, in games, you know, you'd have kids come down on a breakaway layup and they try to shoot with their left hand and they'd miss. And, you know, we'd be on the sideline cheering and say, hey, great job. And by the time those kids were at the end of their fourth grade season, every one of those kids could shoot the ball with their left hand. And I'm betting that the kids in Portugal that you saw, by the time they were another year or two advanced, they were so much further along with being able to pass the ball with one hand because those coaches encouraged a behavior, a skill that wasn't comfortable, that they weren't good at initially. And I think that's something that all coaches need to remember, that if you're trying to get your players to try something new, you have to praise the effort of them trying it as opposed to praising or criticizing whatever the result is. You can't ask kids to shoot a left-handed layup and then when they miss a left-handed layup in a game, you know, have the buzzer sound and have somebody sub it in for them. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, again, coaches, forget about everything else I've said this podcast. Just keep playing that one over and over again and follow that. Because that's it. That's exactly what we don't do at the youth level and what we should be doing all the time at the youth level. And again, as you said, whatever the skill is, like we can develop better skilled players if we'd stay out of their way and we would support them making mistakes in the process of learning. And the other part that goes with that is something that I really value, which is throwing them in the deep end. We use progressions to death in this country, in North America, I shouldn't say this country, but like we love progressions. Well, how do we know the progression for a fourth grader? Well, throw them in the deep end and figure it out. Figure out what you got to teach. Oh, okay, they can't use their left hand very well. Great, let's do that. But then again, the other challenges should be generalized, right? And that's another challenge for coaching, is the specificity for each player is very unique and different. But at that age, certainly you can generalize a little bit more in your example, which is an outstanding one. But like we gotta throw them in the deep end and say, well, they're not okay. They can't throw one hand pass at that age. Why can't they?
Right.
We don't know. They can't because you won't let them, but can they? Well, we don't know unless you let them make mistakes, as in your example.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. We actually had Dave Love on a couple weeks ago. And one of the things that Dave talked about that really got me thinking was I talked about how when I'm working with young players on shooting, I like to teach them the 1-2 step because I feel like it gives them better balance and more power. And Dave said to me, he goes, well, maybe that gave you more power and more balance, but maybe the kid feels differently. And to be honest, that had never once in all the years I've been working with kids, whether it's on a team or an individual, so I had never once stopped to think that maybe somebody else felt that way. And I still, you know, just in my experience of watching kids shoot, I still think that the 1-2 in most cases is better simply because it gives you more power and balance, all the things that I said. But Dave's point was, is that each individual kid is different. And that's the point that you're making, is what may be comfortable for me or maybe comfortable for 90% of the kids may not be comfortable for that one other kid. And you really have to make sure that you're teaching the specificity of what works for each individual player. And sometimes that's hard to do at the youth level with the amount of time and the constraints that you have, but it's important. It goes back to what we talked about at the very beginning, communicating, and all it would take for me to be able to change that mentality is to have a conversation with the kid of, hey, how do you feel when you do this? How do you feel when you do this? And then you get to what you're going to work on with that particular individual. So I thought that was interesting, interesting perspective that Dave brought that I hadn't thought of in that particular way.
Well, there's another thing. If you're not following Dave Love, follow Dave Love, because he's incredible.
He is. Like, again, he just thinks,
if you spend that much time deeply thinking about one subject like that, well, shooting can't be, let's just classify it as one, but there's so many parts of shooting.
Right.
If you're spending so much time deeply thinking about that, then that's someone that you should be following. Because it's just, again, things like that, nuggets that he says like that, that's just so impactful.
No question. All right, so here's my non-basketball related question to your world travels. What was your favorite country that you and your family visited and why?
Oh, this is so good. So give people some perspective. So we lived in California for about 3 months before we went around the world. And then we went to Hawaii, Fiji, New Zealand, Australia, Hong Kong, Vietnam, India, Dubai, and then Portugal, Italy, and Spain and Italy. And, you know, in that whole place, I mean, how can you say, like, I loved Barcelona, I loved Italy, I love all these places. But I'll tell you what, do you know what I valued the most was being dropped in the middle of Hong Kong, in the middle of Vietnam, in the middle of India, even Dubai to a certain extent, places where we were a little bit uncertain. Right, like Australia and New Zealand were phenomenal, and if you ever get a chance, go, because they're incredible. But we're kind of comfortable, right? Europe was kind of comfortable, but some of those other places were completely different, you know, for us, but certainly for our daughters. And I still reflect back on India, and my one daughter's blonde, and I can't tell you, like, we went to visit the Taj Mahal, and I mean, there's this incredible, like, life-changing experience looking at this Taj Mahal, this gorgeous thing that's been there for centuries and was built on love. And so many of these people wanted to just take pictures of my blonde daughter or to touch my blonde daughter. And I'm like, that's the Taj Mahal. Like, what are you doing?
That's funny.
It's just, like, amazing. Oh, they don't see blonde girls that often. So it's, like, just one of those moments that you're just like, okay, this is a little different. But you know what? You'll always remember those moments and – you know, and that's certainly what we value about the experience. And again, I would do it again in a heartbeat. I love travel, and you know, there's objects everywhere, but it's really, again, it comes back to so many different people that I met, and so many people were welcoming and just just incredible in that trip and in that time. And, you know, that's, again, what you come back to when you travel.
Yeah. What a great experience for you to be able to have with your kids, and especially at that time in your life. And it sort of cemented then what's kind of been the next step in your career and what you wanted to do and building out your website and doing all those kinds of things. I want to, we're coming up to about an hour and 20 minutes. I want to give a little bit of talk about, your podcast and talk a little bit about how you got it started and kind of what your goals are with it and just, how much you've enjoyed the process of putting it together. Cause I know we feel, you know, we feel blessed to be able to put our show together, and we have so much fun talking to guys like you and just some of the great people that we've had a chance to talk to. And so just talk a little bit about what your experience has been with the, on the podcasting side of things.
Well, similar to what you're saying, and but I do want people to understand that like a podcast is not easy. Like I think sometimes there's this perception of the finished product because you don't see any of the steps along the way. And I know how hard you guys work at this. I mean, I jumped through the Liam Flynn one and you know, the Dave Love one, some of the other ones that I listen to and stuff. And I know how much, you know, how much there goes into it. And it's not that easy. And I think sometimes people think it is because you're just talking basketball, but you guys clearly. You prepare, you're organized, you have some thought process, but at the same time, what's hard is letting it go where it goes, which is sometimes you want to ask a bunch of questions that you've got organized, but then all of a sudden, like we did tonight, I'm sure we completely went off script a whole bunch of times.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, which is the fun part.
It's the magic. It is the magic, but it's hard. You know, it's hard. And I say the really hard part is trying to get someone to understand it's a conversation. And I've been certainly with coaches on that have talked too long or don't necessarily give me a chance to rephrase or restate or re-ask. And those are the harder ones, the ones that understand it's a conversation. And, you know, those are the ones that are easy and much, much better in terms of that. But I started my wife has run a podcast, Love Fit Mama. She's run a podcast forever, Jen Oliver. And she was the one that kept bugging me to do one. And honestly, I was a little reluctant because of my role at the University of Windsor. I didn't want there to be a perception that I was spending all this time on this and that and all these other things. Because, you know, again, podcast takes time. I mean, you guys are taking an hour and a half out of your night and obviously more time before and after and all the different things that go into it. So, but finally, she convinced me. And again, it's been incredible. I don't know if there's been a singular thing that's built my brand, so to speak, or my business, whatever you want to call it, more than the podcast, because it's, and again, for you, for Mike and Jason, it's given you a voice that you didn't have necessarily when you just shared a blog or you shared a video, right?
Yeah,
it's
no
given
question.
You a chance to talk.
No question.
So like when you said that incredibly intelligent thing tonight, well, many incredible, but the, you know, that singular moment, we always come back to, you know what? Everyone will remember that probably more than they'll remember, you know, just the video you shared on Twitter.
Right.
And I think that's what's really resonated for the podcast.
Yeah. I think, I don't know if you found this, but one of the things that I find to be interesting is, and we haven't experienced it to a huge degree quite yet, but it's interesting that I know that my inspiration back when we first started this, and I kind of had it, I was like you, I had it on my to-do list and I would write it at the top of the to-do list every week. And then I'd get to the next week and I'd rewrite it. And I could never really kind of pull the trigger. And eventually, you know, I found the right partner in Jason, who, you know, is a little bit younger than me and actually came to my basketball camp when he was younger. And then he and I hooked up and he's kind of got some of the tech side of it taken care of. But one of the things that inspired me to want to do the podcast was listening to Alan Stein and his Hardwood Hustle podcast. And you felt like as you were listening to that you kind of got to know Alan and Adam Bradley, and you know, you learned about their kids and you learned about their families. And, you know, and I remember then when I actually got a chance to talk to Alan, I felt like I already knew him. And so I asked him this sort of same question, the same idea was, hey, do people come up to you and ask you about your kids and this and that? And he's like, yeah, people feel like they know me. And it's mostly because of the podcast. And I think that when you have, and this is the point I think you were trying to make, is that when you hear someone's voice, and especially if you're someone who becomes a regular listener and you're listening all the time, you kind of get to know that person, whether it's you on your podcast or Jason and I on ours, you feel like you kind of know that person because you're hearing their voice, you're inviting them into your world all the time. And then, you know, so you feel like you really know that person. And so that's the piece that I find to be interesting. It's a much more personal connection with people, with your audience, with the guests, than it is when you're just writing something. Because like I said, you and I mean, I know I wrote to you and shared a couple things that you've had on your, you know, on your blog, on what I was doing on my website. And, you know, okay, you trade some emails and whatever. But now after you talk to somebody, it just becomes so much more of a personal connection. And that's what I find to be fascinating and just so so satisfying with doing the podcast. And it sounds like you're experiencing some of those same things.
Well, no question. And, you know, selfishly, I started the podcast because I just wanted to have really intense geek out basketball conversations. Oh. And, you know, and again, so much in the basketball world, like, you know, there's your podcast, there's a few other podcasts, but most of them are media driven podcasts where coaches are on there talking about their, you know, talking about things that you or I can Google. Right. Like I don't need to give you my whole background. I need to give you a taste of it and give you an impression. But really, let's get into some stuff that can really help people. And that's really the point. And it's what I like about yours. And it's what I've really enjoyed about mine is, like, I tell coaches a disclaimer, listen, I'm not going to talk about your bio. We're just going to get into basketball talk. And at the end of the day, I mean, one of my favorite moments was when Steve Donahue from Penn was on. And he caught himself mid-sentence going, okay, I guess this is getting a little technical. And I stopped. I could say at that point, I stopped and said, Coach, this is the podcast where you can get completely technical.
That's exactly what we want, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I know, like, for example, my brother, like, big sports fan and all that, but, you know, he said it, and I respect it, and I totally understand. Like, he doesn't listen to mine, you know, because
right.
it's too technical. It's too, you know, basketball geek friendly. So I get it, but that's the niche that, you know, we're trying to get, and it's been great. And I've been grateful. I mean, like, you probably are grateful for the guests. I mean, just people genuinely sharing, right?
Yeah. Like, I don't know how you found, but one of the things that I found to be very, very interesting is that, and I've said this before, but, you know, prior to having the podcast, there would be very little reason for me to reach out to some of the various coaches that we've had a chance to reach out to. And then conversely, there's also just people have been so willing to come on. I mean, you know, obviously we're not reaching out to the NBA players or NBA coaches at this point, but for the most part, anybody that we've reached out in our networking, we had Mark Price, former Cavalier, who we just reached out to him on Twitter, and Mark was nice enough to respond. We said, hey, we're a couple of Cleveland guys, big fans. And, you know, he did respond. But what we found is that most people are wanting to share what they know and are willing to, which is tremendous. And then two, when you give people an opportunity to talk about themselves and talk about things that they're passionate about and things that they want to share about the game of basketball, which, again, I'm sure just like you've experienced, every guest that comes on our show is just, you know, it's a love affair with the game of basketball. And so when you give them a chance to come on and talk about it, it's been a blast. I mean, people ask me all the time, my wife specifically, like, you know, what are you doing with this thing? Where's it going to go? And I always say, you know, I don't know where it's going to go. I don't know what it's going to turn into or if it's going to turn into anything else. But like you, just the opportunity to talk hoops with all these great people that we've had on, that to me is what it's all about. It's just a blast. I mean, every night when Jason and I come and we sit down or we record, it's just, I walk away so refreshed and just excited about the opportunity that we've had to talk to whoever it is that we've talked to. And I'm sure you're experiencing that same thing.
Well, the basketball podcast by Chris Oliver on iTunes or wherever you find them. And then obviously your Hoopshead podcast but on iTunes and wherever you guys can find podcasts. What we're essentially doing here is we're doing a brand exchange, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Absolutely. Like, you know, and again, even if someone doesn't have a podcast that comes on your show, a college coach that you've had, they're doing a brand exchange. And I think there's no better thing than a podcast beyond maybe an actual television interview or some type of video interview,
right,
to be able to exchange brands. And people get to know your coaches, and suddenly it's maybe I have a player for this coach because, you know, I really was impressed with them, or sure, I reach out to this coach to learn from them. And that brand exchange part of it is really important. And you know, again, it'll jumpstart our relationship, and, you know, we'll be texting buddies back and forth and all this other stuff that helps make the world of basketball a better place.
That's exactly right. I could not agree with you any more than that. All right, we're coming up on an hour and a half, Chris, so I know we're going to respect your time, and it's getting to be 11:30 here, and Coach Jason's looking a little groggy over there next to me. So okay. I want to give you a chance before we get out of here. I know we've talked a couple times here, but give you a chance to share your contact information, share out your information about the website and everything that you have going, your podcast. So share it all out with us right now. We'll put it all in our show notes. And then if there's anything that we didn't touch on that you want to leave as your parting shot, go ahead and do that now, and then we'll wrap things up and say goodnight to the audience.
Well, basketballimmersion.com. I mean, you can find our podcast there, but it's Basketball Podcast by Chris Oliver, and at B-Ball Immersion on Twitter is probably the easiest one, but see Oliver at basketballimmersion.com as well. And we have tons of free content on, you know, Basketball Immersion on Instagram, on YouTube, on Facebook. I mean, I'm a big believer in giving away a lot of free content, and we have the membership site as well. And really, I shouldn't say that. It's a misnomer. We have a membership community. We have coaches from all over the world. The other day when we added it up, it was over 29 countries represented in our membership area. And, you know, again, coaches of all level, from the NBA down to youth levels in our membership area. And, you know, we have an interactive area as well, where there's a Facebook mastermind group, which is private for members, where they can interact and share ideas as well. So there's all those different things that have helped create a community. And, that's been amazing. But, you know, to be honest, you can find all that stuff there. People are welcome to contact me anytime, but I just want to say how grateful I am for the people that are listening. Like, not just you guys to invite me on, which is awesome too, but the people that are listening to these podcasts and making this more fun for all of us, and just being open-minded to be able to learn and to be able to stimulate thinking for others. And I think that's really what's evolved from, I assume, your community, but my community as well, is just that idea of stimulating thinking, and one idea leading to another idea. And I never want people to adopt my ideas. I want them to adapt my ideas. Like, I don't want disciples. I want people that take what I share and make it their own, or make it better. And to be honest, it's possible. A lot of my stuff can be made better and has been made better by other people that I've given it to. And I think that's the gratitude that comes back to the people listening and sharing and being a part of any type of community that's involved in basketball, and just great to be a part of any of these discussions. So yeah. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Oh yeah. You're welcome. I couldn't agree more. I think by stimulating people's thinking, by getting them to consider ways of doing things that may be different from the ways that they've done it, and also giving a platform to all the great coaches out there who are not necessarily famous. We all hear about the guys who are on TV and in the Final Four and in the NBA playoffs, but we don't hear about the guys who are doing, or the ladies that are doing, great work at all these different levels of basketball. And you don't have to be famous in order to be doing great things. And I think that's one of the takeaways when I listen to your show, or when people listen to ours. I hope that's one of the things that they take away, that, you know, greatness in coaching can happen everywhere. And if we can stimulate a lot of thinking, and we can get people to buy into some of the great ideas that our coaches are sharing on the show, then I think we've accomplished what we want to do, which is to help grow the game and make the game that we all love, to make it better. And we can't thank you enough, Chris, for coming on and spending an hour and a half with us tonight. I think it's been a great episode. I've enjoyed the conversation. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.